This is the takeaway for Thursday, April 13th, 2017.
Here along our nation's southwest border is ground zero in the fight.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. From a border port of entry in Nogales, Arizona, Attorney General Jeff Sessions got his chance finally to signal what he has demanded for years in the U.S. Senate, a sealed border and a war on the people who have crossed it illegally into the U.S.
Here under the Arizona sun, ranchers work each day to make an honest living. But it's also here, along this border, that transnational gangs and international cartels flood our country with drugs and leave death and violence in their wake. And it is here that criminal aliens and the coyotes and the document forgers seek to overthrow our lawful system of immigration.
It's the President Trump campaign line, higher numbers of prosecutions on felony charges, going after people who harbor undocumented immigrants and those who attempt illegal reentry. The Trump, no more Mr. Nice Guy attitude about immigration is part of a cycle of immigration sentiment and policy that has ebbed and flowed since the Department of Homeland Security was first established in 2002, right after the 9/11 attacks. That cycle has created a quiet monster within the borders of the United States, a shadow court system, a prison system for detainees, a vast immigration infrastructure that President Bush built up and was ultimately modified by President Obama. But it's a contradiction to be both tough on immigration and to have an orderly process for detainees, which earned President Obama at one point the title of Deporter-in-Chief. John Sandwig served as acting director of Immigration and Customs and Enforcement, or ICE, from 2013 to 2014. He also served as general counsel to ICE and is currently an attorney at Frontier Solutions. He lived the contradictions of this policy non-policy and fears that the Trump administration has inherited a system that already is unsustainable.
What we always try to do is divide the immigration and border security kind of world in half. So half of it was focused on the interior, which I would define as the 11.5 million undocumented individuals living in the United States now. The other half of it was what's actually going on at the border. So at the border, the administration's position was always a zero-tolerance policy, right? If you're coming across that border unlawfully, you're going to be apprehended, you're going to be sent home. On the interior, though, look, ICE has the resources, the federal government has the resources to remove really only about 220,000 people in the interior of the United States. And I know the Trump administration is doing a lot of things to try to increase that number, but they're not going to materially be able to impact the total number of removals. Really, it's always going to be less than 2% of the total population, absent some serious increases in the funding provided by Congress. So our position was, look, if you can only remove 2%, let's make it sure it's the worst first. Let's find the public safety threats and the criminals, and let's focus on them. I'm worried that today what we're seeing is a step back away from that, and we're seeing in the administration a step back away from all of our policies to a, hey, we're going to get the lowest hanging fruit because they can be deported. They've been caught the quickest, deported the fastest. Forget about whether they're criminals or not. It's about getting a large number to kind of, you know, show that we followed our campaign promises of getting tough just by increasing the total number of deportations. In doing that, of course, you're going to weaken public safety because less focus on the criminals. At the border, what Sessions announced yesterday, of course, is, you know, I'll be honest. We had, like I said at the moment ago, we had a zero tolerance policy. Federal prosecutions of immigration and border related crimes at the border remain the number one criminal prosecution for federal, you know, in the federal system throughout the Obama administration. But what Sessions said yesterday is they're going to double down on the use of criminal justice authorities to prosecute border crossers as well. It'll be interesting to see how those resources are allocated. I will tell you that the U.S. Attorney's offices along the border are already strained. The federal courts are strained. The public defender systems are strained just by the current volume of prosecutions.
So your view is just approaching this in terms of numbers may work politically, but it's not going to work on the ground.
If your goal is to remove 11.5 million people, it just cannot be done absent insane appropriations increases, right? We already spend billions of dollars on immigration enforcement at ICE. We spend $1.4 billion alone on detention. So those billions get you about 250,000 removals. So let's say your policy, and I don't share this view at all. I mean, I think that we need comprehensive immigration reform quickly. But if you were to come to me and say, John, how do we go ahead and remove all 11.5 million? Forget their individual circumstances, forget if they have U.S. citizen family members. I would tell you it's going to take more than $15 billion annually. And I think that you know, I don't think the taxpayer has an appetite for those kind of appropriations. I don't think the Republican Party has an appetite for those appropriations. And then when you look at the demographics of the population, how long these people have been here, how many of them have U.S. citizen family members, I don't even think it makes sense from a policy perspective.
Why did the Obama administration get tagged as deporter-in-chief? And what was the rationale for creating this huge ICE detention infrastructure, which now, you know, constitutes a kind of shadow prison system around the United States?
Immigration, you can't please anybody in the immigration space, you know, when you're running ICE and running DHS. And just a very quick anecdote is we were at a hearing once where Secretary Napolitano was testifying in the Senate Judiciary Committee. And then Senator Sessions went on a 5-minute diatribe to the secretary about how it was the most lax immigration enforcement in the history of the United States, how we've completely abdicated our responsibility, and then asked the secretary, you know, to comment, not that he was particularly interested in her response. When Secretary Napolitano went to speak, about 30 protesters jumped up in the gallery of the Senate, chanting her down for having the most harsh enforcement apparatus in the history of the United States. So neither extreme, of course, could be true. The reality is that the Obama administration, when we came in on day one in 2009, we inherited a much larger apparatus, more detention beds, more ICE officers than ever before. Doubled, you know, the Bush administration doubled the Border Patrol and dramatically increased ICE. I think, you know, to be honest with you too, John, the way we reported our numbers created a lot of confusion. In 2012, we reported 400,000 plus deportations for ICE. ICE deportation numbers are kind of like the measuring stick in immigration enforcement for how many people are being deported. It's much more confusing than that. And the reality was over half those people that ICE, quote unquote, deported that year were really people the Border Patrol arrested at the border. We did not do a good job. And I was, you know, I'll take blame for some of this myself. We did not do a good job in explaining that to the public. We rolled out this 400,000 number and it just created this impression that we were all about enforcement. Like I said, the reality was much more nuanced. And in later years, when I was the director, we then put out a comprehensive report explaining who these people are that we deported. But I think, you know, the increases in the appropriations and candidly, the way we reported numbers in 2009, 10, 11, and 12 didn't do us any favors in that regard and didn't do the president any favors and created a misleading impression that he was the deporter in chief.
So you just told me we had a zero tolerance policy at the border. And then you described that, well, basically kind of juiced the numbers a little bit to make it look like we were deporting more people than we were. And that was a mistake. I mean, it sounds like you created your own chaos.
Yeah, well, no, I want to be clear. Reducing the numbers, I think, is really unfair. So what ends up happening is that people don't realize this, is that a lot of people the Border Patrol arrest, the Border Patrol can't take them home themselves. That's especially true of Central Americans. The Border Patrol is only funded and equipped, you know, to basically take people home who are from Mexico. Because they can just drive them across the border. But then we have a lot of different operations whereby, let's say, we have a program where Mexicans are apprehended at the border. Instead of just dropping them off at the border, what ends up happening, John, is they come back. It's very common, recidivism at the border. So we ran some programs where the Border Patrol would hand those people over to ICE. ICE would either take them to a different part of the border or ICE would fly them into the interior of Mexico to Mexico City. All the data showed us that it's very expensive, but that people don't come back if they return to Mexico City. And so what ends up happening is ICE truly deported those people. But what we just didn't do, I wouldn't say reduce the numbers, was explain to the public, hey, half these people that were removed by ICE were not people living in the U.S. for a long period of time. These are people caught trying to get into the United States that the Border Patrol handed to ICE, either because they're from Central America and the Border Patrol has no capacity to fly someone to Central America. Only ICE can do that. Or there are people that we try to, you know, pursue to one of these programs. So, you know, that said, you know, I always view, in the Obama administration's view was, if you're trying to get into the country, we can't have any tolerance for that. We have to maintain the integrity of the borders. But if you're already in the country, then we're going to look at you and you look at your individual circumstances.
But why did you ramp up the ICE prison system to a point that it is a shadow detention system in the United States with all kinds of bottlenecks because people can't be processed?
You know, unfortunately, we're not the only ones who are involved in the policymaking, obviously, on immigration. And the Congress has a big say-so. And the detention is it's incredibly unfortunate. I feel very strongly that you can be pro-enforcement but anti-detention. There are other more efficient, more humane ways of dealing with the immigration enforcement system outside of detention. And when you have a massive detention apparatus like we do, you own the lives of those people. And when I was the acting director, it was a tremendous responsibility. And there was a detainee death during my time, and it weighed on me dramatically. But here's the problem. Congress has mandated that ICE maintain a certain number of detention beds.
Which is a way of basically, you know, benefiting private firms that these are subcontracted out to.
Huge business. Huge business. Over half the beds are maintained by private firms. I'll be honest with you, too, John. You know, the worst conditions, though, are generally found in jails. I think people don't realize this. ICE also contracts with local sheriff's offices across the country.
No, we've reported on some of that. But the question is, do you see Sessions accelerating that program or trying to reform it as you seem to want to, as you talk about your regrets?
I think we're going to see a big budget increase for detention, for immigration detention. And I think you're going to see Sessions increasing the Bureau of Prisons and Marshals jails to house more people for immigration-related crimes. I think, unfortunately, they're going to step in the other direction. I think it's a huge waste of money. The bottom line is this. The immigration courts, which are backlogged and overwhelmed, and Sessions did say he was going to increase the number of immigration judges, which I support, but they're overwhelmed. So the way they handle it, understandably so, is to say we're going to focus on people in detention. And what, for the people who want to see immigration enforcement, what that tells them is increased detention because those are the only people who get deported. The reality is that we could, just with some rational thought, I think you could get bipartisan consensus, to transition to alternatives to detention, ankle bracelets, check-ins, things that have proven to work, save the taxpayer a tremendous amount of money, increase, you know, the humanity of the enforcement system, and not be soft on enforcement at all. But it's unfortunate. It doesn't seem that we're going in that direction.
Can you comment on this terror that was expressed by a policy advocate who runs an organization called Mi Gente in Chicago? Her name is Tanya Unzueta. And she herself is undocumented and is trying to advise people during this sort of Trump era as Jeff Sessions begins to outline what's going to happen now.
President Obama released 6,000 people as part of his criminal justice reform and was talking about how this is a country of second chances. And literally 2,000 of those 6,000 people were actually deported and not introduced back into their communities. What we're seeing under President Trump is a much more aggressive effort. And part of the hard thing is that it's actually hasn't been a lot of new things. It's been mostly expansion of the things that already existed.
I mean, she's describing a disaster that's been going on for two administrations now. Is that your view?
No, I don't share the view, John. Honestly, the population that's being focused on right now would have been not have been removed under the Obama administration. And a lot of these folks, and so I understand her concerns, but look, we had a policy as it relates to convicted criminals. But when you look at the people they're focusing on today, they don't care about criminal history. They care about how quickly you can be deported. And you are seeing all these individuals, and I think what she's feeling and what the advocacy community is feeling right now is this fear, because individuals that we granted prosecutorial discretion to, when they're coming in to renew their discretion and their paperwork, they're getting arrested and they're being stripped, taken away from their families and deported. There is no comparison to what is happening today to what happened, you know, what the conditions were a year ago. There just isn't. You got to remember, John, as you know, these people have now been here, the 11.5 million, over 15 years. The majority of them have been here over 15 years. Tension's building, and I agree with you. It'll be interesting to see how that plays out.
Attica?
Well, it's just I don't know that you can put this much pressure on this community for this long without there being some release of it, and it'll be difficult.
John Sandwig was former acting director of ICE from 2013 to 2014, who also served as general counsel to ICE and is currently an attorney at the policy organization in Washington, D.C., Frontier Solutions. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Once there was something called a peace process in the Middle East. The U.S. led efforts to bring about the creation of a state for Palestinians and Israeli concessions to give up territory, won in the wars of 1948, 1967, and 1973. But few people talk about that process anymore. Secretary of State John Kerry was the last person to make a serious initiative, and it went nowhere. Israeli author Nir Bahram has traveled throughout East Jerusalem and the West Bank, talking to Israeli settlers and displaced Palestinians. And what he found are people living side by side who he says have lost any common vision of the future, while the once active superpowers are stuck in dreams of peace plans from the 1980s.
To be honest, you know, most of the discourse in the States and also in Europe is a total zombie discourse.
Zombie.
Yeah, that has no understanding of what's going on in Israel. And I think that 50-60% of the Israelis feel that they are entitled to the whole land without Palestinians, but also vice versa. And there is something fundamental in the two narratives that they are not meeting in the crucial points. It's not just about the two-state solution. It's not just about trying to see it a pragmatic point. There is a deeper, more substantial problem here that we need to address. And most of the international community are talking about the conflict in a way that most of the people in the West Bank and in Jerusalem, Jews or Palestinians, feel alienated to.
I would think. I mean, this is an impression that I used to get when I was there in the 80s, and it was much closer.
Yeah.
You know, the outside and the inside were closer to reality. But now it seems, do any Israelis really talk about the two-state solution? That, you know, there's going to be some sort of process, somebody who swoops in and changes things?
We are in the post-process era. I don't think that people seriously believe in a process. The Kerry Initiative was the last initiative that nobody took seriously in Israel, really, and also in Palestine. And I think that there are more fundamental issues that the Palestinian wants, like freedom of movement. The desire for a Palestinian state is something they didn't hear so much, also because they have the Palestinian Authority and they saw what it did, and it did nothing for them. So it's about freedom of movement. It's about opening the borders. It's about the ability to plan their lives. It's about economical progress. It's about the land. They care about the village of their parents, the house. Also something very important, the green line. For most of the people in the West Bank, means nothing. Palestinians and settlers. It's not part of their
of the their 1967 line.
Yeah, it's just a line that they drew in Rhodes, but it's not part of their political DNA. Most of the Palestinians don't see the green line as very important for them. They think about Palestine.
Here's just one of the scenes that's typical of your book here. You were in a butcher shop, and you were talking to someone who said, you don't talk about Jewish terrorism, only Palestinian terrorism. I watch your TV channels every morning, and there's no such thing as Jewish terrorism. You only broadcast what's convenient for you. We don't believe a word on Israeli media, someone says. Did that surprise you when he said that?
You know, there is a resentment that was surprising for me, the level of the resentment. They don't believe anything from the Israeli media. They don't believe anything of the Israeli IDF. It's very easy to demonize both sides right now because they don't meet. There is this sense that we always say that it cannot go on. Something has to change. But if you think about it, since 67, there is a very persistent status quo that sustained. And we want to believe that we will change it. And we want to believe that it cannot go on. But Netanyahu, I think, understood that the status quo is the best idea for the Israeli right wing. But I think it morally destroyed the Israeli society, corrupted the Israeli society. And the price we pay for it is something that people in the U.S. cannot see all the time.
What's your part of the immorality?
My part, I think that we are all held a responsibility for the occupation. We are all part of this society that maintained the occupation. Even if I spend most of my life resisting the occupation, I'm part of it. I'm responsible for it. And I always say to everyone that we are part of it. That I went there and I tried to write about all aspects of the occupation. But I don't feel morally superior on this part because I know that we are all responsible for it.
Do you feel guilty?
Well, I have to say, when I was there and I saw the scale of the occupation and how regular Palestinians cannot plan their day because there is a blockade, because there is IDF soldiers, sometimes I felt guilty, but I don't think it's a very helpful feeling. I still feel obligated to do whatever I can to end the occupation. And in this book, it was very important for me to suggest ideas that can do it. And I think that this is still a battle that right now we are losing. But I'm not living in Israel with zero hope. And I think that I'm part of an important resistance to the occupation that also think that it's not just about resisting. It's about offering a new path to create a Palestinian-Israeli peace process that don't just take the 67 war under account, but take the whole conflict under account. But in order to make it, you have to open your mind. We are talking about the same ideals for 40 years. The liberal camp changed nothing, thought about nothing, didn't offer anything new. And maybe we're in a situation that we need some new ideas.
Well, it's a journey, a remarkable journey, and full of new ideas. Your book, A Land Without Borders, My Journey Around East Jerusalem and the West Bank. Nir Baram, thank you so much.
Thank you for your time.
Earlier this week, the artist of the deal himself, President Donald Trump, offered China better trade terms in exchange for cooperative help on North Korea and its dangerous nuclear program. The offer may go somewhere, but Japan apparently doesn't believe it. Doesn't believe that the U.S. and China can constrain Kim Jong-un on their own. So on Wednesday, Japan announced its latest strategy. It will send destroyers to the East China Sea to team up with the United States aircraft carrier strike group. There is a possibility, even an expectation, of another North Korean missile test. The latest one occurred last week ahead of Donald Trump's first meeting with Chinese President Xi Jinping. And this Saturday is North Korea's Day of the Sun, the most important national holiday, commemorating the birth of North Korean founder Kim Il-sung. Last year, Kim Jong-un attempted a missile launch on the holiday. Lindsay Ford is the director for security programs for the Asia Society Policy Institute.
They're clearly determined to have a nuclear capability, and they believe that it's essential to regime survival. If anything, I think that probably this past week, the Trump administration's decision to launch a strike in Syria has probably reinforced that belief for them. They see what's happened in other places in the Middle East, and the takeaway lesson is if you don't have nuclear weapons, you get ousted and you get attacked, and therefore we have to have them, and it's the only thing that will ensure that we stay around.
So speaking that way, it sounds as though Kim Jong-un is committed to demonstrating to the world a nuclear delivery capacity, missile plus warhead, at some point in the next year or two.
Absolutely. I think when you look at the pace of the testing that they've undertaken over the last couple of years, it's clearly escalating. And the challenge that this poses for the United States and for other allies and partners is that in the past, the gamble was essentially that you could convince the North Koreans to trade away their nuclear capabilities. There's growing concern that assessment is not accurate and that Kim Jong-un has absolutely no intention of trading it away. And that makes our policy options much more challenging.
Japan moving a naval force in with the Vinson suggests that Japan doesn't believe anymore that this can be handled without it taking some kind of a stand. What's going on in Japan?
We have to remember there's a few audiences here. So obviously one is North Korea. And you're trying to send a strong signal to the North Koreans that the United States and allies like Japan are standing closely alongside each other and have significant military capabilities to deter North Korean activities and to respond to them if they had to. But there's a domestic audience as well. And, you know, in Japan, as in South Korea, the folks at home are keenly aware of the fact that were there to actually be a crisis on the North Korean peninsula, Japan and South Korea would be really the first place where the North Koreans would lash out. So it's a serious threat for them. And being able to say we operate closely alongside the United States and that we're ready to respond to any of these challenges is a really important message to send to folks at home.
But does Kim Jong-un fear the Japanese at all? Does the Japanese taking a higher profile here in any way make Kim Jong-un think differently about this mission to demonstrate a nuclear capability?
I don't think it's not the Japanese alone in the same way that it's not realistically the United States alone. It has to do with the combined capabilities of the United States, South Korea, Japan together. I think clearly Kim Jong-un cares about these types of activities because we see, that he responds very strongly a lot of times when South Korea, when the United States, when Japan engage in exercises and training and these types of actions together. I think we have to be realistic that this alone doesn't necessarily solve or deter North Korea from their nuclear program. I think it is one piece of a much larger, more complicated puzzle.
In your view of the entire region, if Kim Jong-un demonstrates nuclear weapons in some way that is more open, because an underground test is very different from a delivery of a missile warhead, does that take the constraints off of Donald Trump to consider some sort of nuclear gesture in the East China Sea that might completely change the game since the end of the Korean War?
Yeah, I think we got to be careful about nuclear gestures. That's a high-stakes way to send a signal.
You heard the rhetoric from the campaign just as I did here. We heard what Donald Trump said about the U.S. nuclear capacity and that he might consider it.
We did. But, you know, then you also saw when he met with Xi Jinping last week, coming out of the talk, much as it was on healthcare and many other things, was suddenly, I had a conversation with Xi Jinping. He kind of explained to me the longstanding relationship between China and North Korea, and who knew that it was so complicated. So, you know, there was some campaign rhetoric that was a lot of saber rattling. I think what you've seen more recently coming out of the administration, quite frankly, is probably going to be a enhanced version of what you saw under the Obama administration, which is going to be the near-term focus on increased sanctions. That's where they're going to put pressure on the Chinese, is to really try to ratchet up cutting off North Korea's economic lifelines. They'll try to do some more work through the UN, cut off sort of their remaining diplomatic and political connections around the world. I don't think that you're going to see them go first to a military option. It doesn't mean it's not on the table. It's always on the table. But the reality is that any military options on the North Korean peninsula, you don't want to go there first, because you have a regime that has the capability to strike the United States, potentially, to strike our allies, our forces in other countries. And if you had a crisis on the North Korean peninsula, the economic consequences, of a massive war in East Asia would be, really unprecedented.
Lindsay Ford is Director for Security Programs for the Asia Society Policy Institute. Lindsay, thank you so much.
Thank you.
If you love this podcast or any others, we need your help. All this month, we here at The Takeaway, along with lots of our partners and friends across the audio world, are trying to spread the word about podcasts. So here's what we need. We're asking you to tell a friend about a podcast they'll love. Right now, think of a friend, your mom, anyone you care about. What podcast would they really love? Got it now? Do it. Tell them about it in real life or on social media. And if they don't know about podcasts, show them how. It's easy. Tell them what you recommended with the hashtag tripod, TRYPOD. Thanks for spreading the word. It's been a constant presence in Haiti for over a decade, but today the United Nations Security Council voted to end the UN peacekeeping mission in 6 months. It began in Haiti in 2004 after an armed uprising ousted the country's democratically elected president. But Haitians elected a new president earlier this year, and UN officials, including U.S. Ambassador Nikki Haley, said the vote shows the country is ready to take more control of its own security. UN peacekeepers were seen, though, as responsible for the country's deadly cholera epidemic, which began in 2010 and killed thousands of people. So the UN will have a mixed legacy in Haiti when this comes to an end in 6 months. Under the new plan, the force would pull out in October, leaving a small contingent behind. Jacqueline Charles is the Haiti correspondent for the Miami Herald and says the UN peacekeeping mission has been a long, complicated journey.
For a lot of Haitians, they will be saying good riddance when we look at the history of the UN in Haiti these past 13 years, in terms, especially with cholera, the cholera outbreak that has killed so many and infected a lot of people, and of course the controversy over the rapes of a number of children, as we reported this weekend. But at the same time, the UN did provide a psychological benefit for Haiti and for Haitians, especially for the private sector, that want to see direct foreign direct investment, that want to see tourism, that's concerned about the ability of the Haitian National Police to address the security of the country. So I think Haitians are going to have a lot of mixed, feelings. And at the same time, the UN, they rented houses, they ate in the restaurants. Some people say they were sort of semi-permanent tourists. So the country is really at a crossroads, a turning point, and it's going to be interesting to see what happens after October 15th. But I think, in the case of Haiti, the UN, there's a lot of history, there's a lot of lessons, past lessons that need to be learned and not repeated. You know, the last time the U.N. left Haiti, within a year of its departure, the Haitian National Police collapsed under political pressure, and then the U.N. was back basically 2 years later. So they're hoping not to have a repeat of that.
What will the small contingent of U.N. personnel represent under the proposed Gutierrez plan, which would really mean that there's going to be a U.N. office in Haiti more or less indefinitely?
Well, I don't know indefinitely. I mean, they're talking about sort of a 2-year transition, and it's agreement among the member states that there's still a lot of work to be done, especially in the area of justice, human rights, and police development. The current mission, which is $346 million a year, is going to be severely scaled back. Even the civilians who work for the UN, that's going to diminish by about 30%. But as far as the post-MINUSTA, post-peacekeeping operations, the focus is really how to get a working justice system in Haiti, because right now the judiciary is just completely dysfunctional. Human rights, we've seen issues with prisons, the prisoners, you know, people spending more time in jail than the sentencing on the crime. And then within the prison system, there's been a human rights crisis there. And then with police development, which is very important because the international community led by the United States has spent a lot of money over the last couple of years in trying to build and develop a professional police force that is not to be politicized and that should be independent. And I think that's going to be one of the biggest challenge for this post-MINUSTA United Nations mission in Haiti.
Jacqueline Charles is the Haiti correspondent for the Miami Herald. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Instability in the Philippines is driving that nation's aggressive politics, driving a vigilante program to fight the war on drugs. It's holding back the economy and is beginning to be reflected in that nation's public health priorities. The Philippines may soon run completely out of contraceptives. Responding to anti-abortion religious groups, the Supreme Court of the Philippines in 2015 issued a temporary restraining order on registrations for birth control. As part of our partnership with News Deeply, we spoke with Anna B. Santos. She's a journalist based in Manila covering reproductive rights. And she says the country is compromising women's health while the rest of the world looks away.
It's very hard to get people to understand that there's this crisis going on right now when it comes to reproductive health and our contraceptive supplies. People think that there is already a reproductive health law, so there's no need to push for anything because a law is there. But there is a Supreme Court temporary restraining order on the licensing of contraceptive pills. So the supplies that we have right now in the public health clinics and even in the drug stores, there's no way for the government right now to bring in new supplies or to replenish the ones that are being bought off as they are being used.
How urgent is this in general, and are these reproductive issues in general for the Philippines?
This is a very urgent issue. Public health officials have already called it a public health emergency. Data from the Population Commission of the Philippines says that we have 48 contraceptive brands in the market. 20 already have lapsed. Their product registrations have lapsed. Once they run out, there'll be no more of that available. And that's what you'll see, John, a gradual phasing out of contraceptives in the market.
And how many women does this affect?
13 million women. That's the number of women who are roughly using contraceptives. But there is also what we call women who need it but can't have access to it. That's about 6 million.
And does the very outspoken president help matters or hurt matters in paying attention or not to this issue?
You know, John, that's a very important question because we're going up against the Supreme Court here. It's the Supreme Court that has issued a TRO on the licenses and product registrations of birth control pills and other contraceptives. But the president is very much for family planning. In fact, he signed an executive order just last January calling for a full implementation. That's what it says in the EO, a full implementation of the family planning law. The problem is the president is from the executive branch and the Supreme Court is from the judiciary. They're equal branches of government. His executive order isn't enough to overturn that TRO. It should start pushing the needle in terms of adding pressure on the Supreme Court to say, hey, the president is for family planning. And therefore, you should also support the president. Also, it's been laid out as part of a development agenda to alleviate poverty.
Why do you think the president isn't stepping up and trying to urge the court to move more quickly?
He needs to do more. And we've seen that he can do more with the way that he has supported other initiatives of his, like the war on drugs, for example. But he can step up the ante, especially given that scenario that I just explained to you where supplies are dwindling. So we're not just going against the Supreme Court now, we're going against time.
So this public health issue, where does it fit in terms of urgency on the part of the government and Filipino citizens compared to the war on drugs, compared to the war against terrorism, and compared to the economy?
It's really hard to find the mind space for reproductive health right now, given all of those things that you said. Those things look more urgent. You see blood, you see people dying. It doesn't kind of compare, you know, when you say, oh, we're running out of birth control pills. I fear that we'll only begin to feel the full impact of this once we totally start running out and there's like nothing left to buy, because that's what's going to happen. And I've asked the public health experts, what's the worst case scenario? What can happen? You're not going to stop birth control pills from coming in. So you have a black market for it. And the black market, you'll have fake birth control pills. You'll have counterfeit birth control pills. You'll have adulterated ones. That's so harmful. You'll have unintended pregnancies. And abortion is illegal in the Philippines. So with the increased unintended pregnancies, you'll have increased abortions. And abortions here, because they're illegal, are unsafe. So you'll have more women dying. It's a very dire, dire situation.
Anna P. Santos is a journalist and Pulitzer Center grantee writing about reproductive health. She's based in Manila. Anna, thank you so much.
Thanks, John, for the time.
Listen to this voice. It calls to young people, a voice that's been telling them that their dream world is real, telling them that for decades.
Some mornings, I wake up crying without knowing why. That sort of thing happens now and again.
Whatever the dream was I had, I can never remember it. But...
The only thing that does last when I wake up is a sense of loss, which lingers for a long time afterwards.
This is the opening sequence of Your Name from director Makoto Shinkai, already the highest-grossing anime film of all time, currently raking in over $330 million worldwide before hitting U.S. theaters this week, where it has a nearly 97% Rotten Tomatoes score. A teenage boy in Tokyo swaps bodies with a teenage girl in the countryside. They discover love and a futuristic cathedral of time travel. This anime movie is so big that the director said back in December, quote, "It's not healthy. I don't think any more people should see it." The director and film Your Name, in a way that is both universal and uniquely Japanese, has struck an international chord for this style of filmmaking. There's been a rise in interest for anime here in the U.S. since the 9/11 attacks. Susan Napier is professor of Japanese studies at Tufts University and author of Anime from Akira to Howl's Moving Castle. She believes anime speaks to the world without losing its Japanese character.
I think that anime is the easiest thing to say is, yes, it's Japanese animation, but there are certain kinds of aesthetics and a kind of background and tradition that Japanese animation is coming from that's quite different from Western animation. And I think it's one reason why it's so distinctive. And it doesn't appeal to everybody, but the people it appeals to, they really, really love it because it's speaking to something in them that they don't get in Hollywood animation.
The Japanese have a sense that their story is unique. And I'm wondering if anime reflects that in a sense, that it is a national, almost religious story, but it is it's a fable for the world at the same time.
Exactly. I always say I teach a course on several courses on anime. And one of the things about anime is it's both very culturally specific. It has a kind of feel, an emotional depth to it that is, we could say, very Japanese. In particular, there's a term from Japanese poetry and philosophy, mono no aware, the sadness of things. There's a sense of the transience and the lyrical beauty of life that is beautiful precisely because things don't last. And that's very Japanese. But at the same time, the things that anime talks about, and it does or expresses, and it does it more in depth than, say, a Disney or a regular Hollywood film would do, are things that everyone can relate to. Love, loss, trauma, just a coming of age, all these things that really appeal across a global audience.
Miyazaki, who is such a famous director, who in many ways, Makoto Shinkai is, I don't know, he follows in the footsteps of, took on stories that were everything from whimsical childhood imagination to the nuclear attacks at Nagasaki and Hiroshima. What did Miyazaki achieve, and what do you think Shinkai could possibly achieve with this new film, Your Name?
Whoa, that's a big question. Maybe I should mention that I literally just finished a book on Miyazaki. So I could go on and on, but I'll try not to. What did Miyazaki achieve? I think he was able to, first of all, gorgeous imagery and incredibly immersive world building, which I also think, of course, Shinkai does as well, and a willingness to show young people, in Miyazaki's case, particularly children, in very difficult and often traumatic situations, which they deal with, and they show resilience and enthusiasm. It is a vision of a complex world that is both beautiful and terrifying and sublime and disturbing that young people can navigate. And I would say that's also very true with Shinkai. I mean, they're very different directors. I think you're right that Shinkai can be seen as a successor to Miyazaki in that he has the kind of quality of originality that Miyazaki has. What's interesting with Shinkai, as opposed to Miyazaki, is that he's dealing particularly with adolescents and young people in their 20s. I think it's one reason why Shinkai and this latest film in particular are doing so well with young adults, because he really is kind of expressing and conveying some of the difficult emotions of growing up, of going from adolescence into adulthood, and the loneliness and the fears and the insecurities, and also yet these wonderful rich moments of discovery and epiphanies that happen when you're young, and they're so exciting.
Your Name is full of fear. It's full of a kind of teenage, almost using this idea of body swapping the same way as you swap files online. It very much imagines a young people's kind of culture of K-pop and digital virtualness. But Shinkai also seems to be afraid of success at the same time. Why would you say, I don't think any more people should see this, the highest grossing anime film of all time?
Well, I think, first of all, I love your point about the swapping files and how they swap bodies in a way, not totally easily, but with less sort of shock and horror than you might expect. And you're right that there is a sense of the virtual as being very, very close to our reality kind of all the time. But why would Shinkai not want people to see the film? I think that's partly modesty. I think in Japan there still is a high value placed on not kind of talking yourself up, on not kind of bragging all the time. I also think in Shinkai's case, he sounds like a very decent, somewhat shy person. And at the same time, he wants to show his beautiful work and express himself. But yeah, it must be a little bit shocking to have this kind of global reception. I'm sure that the success can seem like a two-edged sword to someone as thoughtful and as philosophical as he is.
How does anime liberate you as a person who studied it for 20 years?
Wow, nice question. It allows me to go into an alternative reality that is incredibly immersive. I think animation in general, and anime in particular, is such a really kind of like a dreamlike other world that at the same time is logical and seamless once you walk into it. I think that animation as a medium offers you a different kind of reality. And it's very, very appealing and alluring. And I think it's not just me, but I see my students too, that it seems in some ways, I have one book in which I interview anime fans, and so many of them say it's more real than Hollywood, or it's more real even than real life. And what I think they mean by that is they get into this alternative world in which you can kind of perform and process things in a different way than you do in the kind of detritus of reality. And so anime offers you maybe a therapeutic tool because of it's often magical or beautiful or fantasy, that you can deal with difficult things at arm's length in a more comfortable way than you would with a more realistic live-action work. And I think that this is why animation and fantasy and science fiction so often go together, because they're giving you reality, but it's a little bit displaced. So it's a little bit more comfortable to deal with your own difficult issues and reality, but by kind of seeing them in this more fantastic, often more beautiful space.
Susan Napier is professor of Japanese studies at Tufts University, author of Anime, From Akira to Howl's Moving Castle. Thank you so much.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
So what entertainment have you sampled through the growing screens and the digital window on the world?
This is Kate. I'm calling from Denver. I have an interest in Japan, and lately I've been enjoying content from Japanese and expat bloggers on culture, fashion, social issues, etc. I love how this entertainment medium lets me in on the lives and experiences of regular people all over the world.
Hi, John. This is Ryan from Minnesota. And I actually got into Indian pop music, of all things, from the digital age. I saw a Dollar Mindy song used in a meme once and looked him up and found out I really liked Indian pop music.
From Erie, Pennsylvania, I've discovered Iranian cinema. I also watch UK TV and a lot of Scandinavian films. Thanks so much for listening. Weigh in on anything you heard today. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or send us a tweet at The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.